lodge was shimmering, like the surface of a lake seen from a distance. The shimmering wall of air parted like a silver curtain, and then a tall man was standing next to Hodge, as if he had coalesced out of the humid air.
"Starkweather," he said, "you have the cup."
Hodge raised the cup in his hands, but said nothing. He appeared paralyzed, whether with fear or astonishment, it was impossible to tell. He had always seemed tall to Clary, but now he looked hunched and small.
"My Lord Valentine," he said finally, "I had not expected you so quickly."
Valentine. He bore little resemblance to the handsome boy in the photograph, though his eyes were still black. His face was not what she had expected. It was a restrained, closed, interior face, the face of a priest, with sorrowful eyes. Creeping out beneath the black cuffs of his tailored suit were the ridged white scars that spoke of years of the Steely.
"I told you I would come to you through a portal," he said.
His voice was resonant and strangely familiar.
"Didn't you believe me?"
"Yes, it's just, I thought you'd send Pangborn or Blackwell, not come yourself."
"You think I would send them to collect the cup? I am not a fool. I know its lore."
Valentine held out his hand, and Clary saw, gleaming on his finger, a ring that was the twin of Jace's.
"Give it to me."
But Hodge held the cup fast.
"I want what you promised me first."
"First? You don't trust me, Starkweather."
Valentine smiled, a smile not without humor in it.
"I'll do as you asked. A bargain is a bargain. Though I must say I was astonished to get your message. I wouldn't have thought you'd mind a life of hidden contemplation, so to speak. You never were much for the battlefield."
"You don't know what it's like,"
Hodge said, letting out his breath with a hissing gasp.
"Being afraid all the time."
"That's true. I don't."
Valentine's voice was as sorrowful as his eyes, as if he pitied Hodge. But there was dislike in his eyes, too, a trace of scorn.
"If you did not intend to give the cup to me," he said, "you should not have summoned me here."
Hodge's face worked.
"It is not easy to betray what you believe in, those who trust you."
"Do you mean the Lightwoods or their children?"
"Both,"
said Hodge.
"Ah, the Lightwoods."
Valentine reached out and with a hand caressed the brass globe that stood on the desk, his long fingers tracing the outlines of continents and seas.
"But what do you owe them, really? Yours is the punishment that should have been theirs. If they had not had such high connections in the Clave, they would have been cursed along with you. As it is, they are free to come and go, to walk in the sunlight like ordinary men. They are free to go home."
His voice, as he said home, thrilled with all the meaning of the word. His finger had stopped moving over the globe. Clary was sure he was touching the place where Idris would be. Hodge's eyes darted away.
"They did what anyone would do."
"You would not have done it. I would not have done it. To let a friend suffer in my place. And surely it must engender some bitterness in you, Starkweather, to know that they so easily left this fate to you."
Hodge's shoulders shook.
"But it is not the children's fault. They have done nothing."
"I never knew you to be so fond of children, Starkweather," Valentine said,
as if the idea entertained him. The breath rattled in Hodge's chest.
"Jace!"
"You will not speak of Jace."
For the first time, Valentine sounded angry. He glanced at the still figure on the floor.
"He is bleeding," he observed. "Why?"
Hodge held the cup against his heart. His knuckles were white.
"It's not his blood. He's unconscious, but not injured."
Valentine raised his head with a pleasant smile.
"I wonder," he said, "what he will think of you when he wakes. Betrayal is never pretty, but to betray a child,
That's a double betrayal, don't you think?
You won't hurt him, whispered Hodge. You swore you wouldn't hurt him.
I never did that, said Valentine. Come now. He moved away from the desk toward Hodge, who flinched away like a small trapped animal. Clary could see his misery.
And what would you do if I said I did plan to hurt him? Would you fight me? Keep the cup from me? Even if you could kill me, the Clave will never lift your curse. You'll hide here till you die, terrified to do so much as open a window too widely. What wouldn't you trade away, not to be afraid any longer? What wouldn't you give up to go home again?
Clary tore her eyes away. She could no longer bear the look on Hodge's face. In a choked voice, he said,
Tell me you won't hurt him, and I'll give it to you.
No, said Valentine, even more softly. You will give it to me anyway.
And he reached out his hand. Hodge closed his eyes. For a moment, his face was the face of one of the marble angels beneath the desk, pained and grave and crushed beneath a terrible weight. Then he swore pathetically under his breath and held the mortal cup out for Valentine to take, though his hand shook like a leaf in a high wind.
Thank you, said Valentine.
He took the cup and eyed it thoughtfully.
I do believe you've dented the rim.
Hodge said nothing. His face was gray. Valentine bent down and gathered up Jace. As he lifted him up lightly, Clary saw the impeccably cut jacket tighten over his arms and back, and she realized that he was a deceptively massive man, with a torso like the trunk of an oak tree. Jace, limp in his arms, looked like a child by comparison.
He'll be with his father soon, said Valentine, looking down at Jace's white face. Where he belongs.
Hodge flinched. Valentine turned away from him and walked back toward the shimmering curtain of air that he had come through. He must have left the portal door open behind him, Clary realized. Looking at it was like looking at sunlight bouncing off the surface of a mirror. Hodge reached out an imploring hand.
Wait, he cried. What of your promise to me? You swore to end my curse.
That is true, said Valentine.
He paused and looked hard at Hodge, who gasped and stepped back, his hand flying to his chest as if something had struck him in the heart. Black fluid seeped out around his splayed fingers and trickled to the floor. Hodge lifted his scarred face to Valentine.
Is it done?
He asked wildly.
The curse, is it lifted?
Yes, said Valentine.
And may your bought freedom bring you joy.
And with that, he stepped through the curtain of glowing air. For a moment, he himself seemed to shimmer, as if he stood underwater. Then he vanished, taking Jace with him. Chapter 20. In Wrath's Alley. Hodge, gasping, stared after him, his fists clenching and unclenching at his sides. His left hand was gloved with the wet dark fluid that had seeped from his chest. The look on his face was a mixture of exultation and self-loathing.
Hodge!
Clary slammed her hand into the invisible wall between them. Pain shot up her arm, but it was nothing compared to the searing pain inside her chest. She felt as if her heart were going to slam its way out of her ribcage. Jace, Jace, Jace! The words echoed in her mind, wanting to be screamed out loud. She bit them back.
Hodge, let me out!
Hodge turned, shaking his head.
I can't,
he said, using his immaculately folded handkerchief to rub at his stained hand. He sounded genuinely regretful.
You'll only try to kill me.
I won't, she said, I promise.
But you were not raised a shadow hunter, he said, and your promises mean nothing.
The edge of his handkerchief was smoking now, as if he dipped it in acid, and his hand was no less blackened. Frowning, he abandoned the project.
But Hodge, she said desperately, didn't you hear him? He's going to kill Jace.
He didn't say that.
Hodge was at the desk now, opening a drawer, taking out a piece of paper.
He drew a pen from his pocket, tapping it sharply against the edge of the desk to make the ink flow. Clary stared at him. Was he writing a letter?
Hodge, she said carefully. Valentine said Jace would be with his father soon. Jace's father is dead. What else could he have meant?
Hodge didn't look up from the paper he was scribbling on.
It's complicated. You wouldn't understand.
I understand enough. Her bitterness felt like it might burn through her tongue. I understand that Jace trusted you and you traded him away to a man who hated his father and probably hates Jace too, just because you're too cowardly to live with a curse you deserved.
Hodge's head jerked up. Is that what you think?
It's what I know. He laid his pen down, shaking his head. He looked tired and so old, so much older than Valentine had looked, though they were the same age.
You only know bits and fragments, Clary, and you're better off that way.
He folded the piece of paper he'd been writing on into a neat square and tossed it into the fire, which flared up a bright acidic green before subsiding.
What are you doing? Clary demanded.
Sending a message.
Hodge turned away from the fire. He was standing close to her, separated only by the invisible wall. She pressed her fingers against it, wishing she could dig them into his eyes, though they were as sad as Valentine's had been angry.
You are young, he said. The past is nothing to you, not even another country as it is to the old, or a nightmare as it is to the guilty. The Clave laid this curse on me because I aided Valentine, but I was hardly the only member of the Circle to serve him. Were the Lightwoods not as guilty as I was? Were not the Waylands? Yet I was the only one cursed to live out my life without being able to set so much as a foot outdoors, not so much as a hand through the window.
That's not my fault, said Clary. It's not Jace's fault. Why punish him for what the Clave did? I can understand giving Valentine the cup, but Jace? He'll kill Jace just like he killed Jace's father.
Valentine, said Hodge, did not kill Jace's father.
A sob broke free from Clary's chest. I don't believe you. All you do is tell lies. Everything you've ever said was a lie.
Ah, he said, the moral absolutism of the young, which allows for no concessions. Can't you see, Clary, that in my own way I'm trying to be a good man?
She shook her head. It doesn't work that way. The good things you do don't cancel out the bad ones. But, she bit her lip, if you told me where Valentine was.
No,
he breathed the word.
It is said that the Nephilim are the children of men and angels. All that this angelic heritage has given to us is a longer distance to fall.
He touched the invisible surface of the wall with his fingertips.
You were not raised as one of us. You have no part of this life of scars and killing. You can still get away. Leave the Institute, Clary, as soon as you can. Leave and never come back.
She shook her head.
I can't, she said. I can't do that. Then you have my condolences, he said, and walked out of the room.
The door closed behind Hodge, leaving Clary in silence. There was only her own harsh breathing and the scrabble of her fingertips against the ungiving, transparent barrier between her and the door. She did exactly what she told herself she wouldn't do, and flung herself against it, again and again, until she was exhausted and her sides ached. Then she sank to the floor and tried not to cry. Somewhere on the other side of this barrier, Alec was dying, while Isabel waited for Hodge to come and save him. Somewhere beyond this room, Jace was being shaken roughly awake by Valentine. Somewhere, her mother's chances were ebbing away, moment by moment, second by second. And she was trapped here, as useless and helpless as the child she was. She sat bolt upright then, remembering the moment at Madame Dorothea's when Jace had pressed the steely into her hand. Had she ever given it back to him? Holding her breath, she felt in her left jacket pocket. It was empty. Slowly, her hand crept into the right pocket, her sweaty fingers picking up lint and then skidding across something hard, smooth, and round. The steely. She bounded to her feet, her heart pounding, and felt with her left hand for the invisible wall. Finding it, she braced herself, inching the tip of the steely forward with her other hand until it rested against the smooth, level air. Already an image was forming in her mind, like a fish rising up through cloudy water, the pattern of its scales growing clearer and clearer as it neared the surface. Slowly at first, and then more confidently, she moved the steely across the wall, leaving searingly bright ash-white lines hovering in the air before her. She felt when the rune was done and lowered her hand, breathing hard. For a moment, everything was motionless and silent, and the rune hung like glowing neon, burning her eyes. Then came a sound like the loudest shattering she had ever heard, as if she were standing under a waterfall of stones, listening to them crash to the ground all around her. The rune she had drawn turned black and sifted away like ash. The floor trembled under her feet. Then it was over, and she knew, without a doubt, that she was free. Still holding the steely, she raced to the window and pushed the curtain aside. Twilight was falling, and the streets below were bathed in a reddish-purple glow. She caught a clear glimpse of Hodge crossing a street, his gray head bobbing above the crowd. She dashed out of the library and down the stairs, pausing only to shove the steely back into her jacket pocket. She took the stairs running and hit the street with a stitch already forming in her side. People walking their dogs in the humid twilight jumped aside as she barreled down the walkway alongside the East River. She caught sight of herself in the darkened window of an apartment building as she careened around a corner. Her sweaty hair was plastered to her forehead, her face crusted with dried blood. She reached the intersection where she had seen Hodge. For a moment, she thought she'd lost him. She darted through the crowd near the subway entrance, shouldering people aside, using her knees and elbows as weapons. Sweaty and bruised, Clary pulled free of the crowd just in time to see a flash of tweed suit disappear around the corner of a narrow service alley between two buildings. She wriggled around a dumpster and into the mouth of the alley. The back of her throat felt like it was burning every time she breathed. Though it had been twilight on the street, here in the alley it was as dark as nightfall. She could just see Hodge, standing at the far end of the alley, where it dead-ended into the back of a fast food restaurant. Restaurant trash was piled outside, heaping bags of food, dirty paper plates, and plastic cutlery that crunched unpleasantly under his boots as he turned to look at her. She remembered a poem she'd read in English class. "I think we are in Rat's Alley, where the dead men lost their bones."
"You followed me," he said. "You shouldn't have."
"I'll leave you alone if you just tell me where Valentine is."
"I can't do that," he said.
"He'll
know I told you, and my freedom will be as short as my life."
"It will be anyway when the Clave finds out that you gave the mortal cup to Valentine," Clary pointed out, "after tricking us into finding it for you. How can you live with yourself, knowing what he plans to do with it?" He cut her off with a short laugh.
"I fear Valentine more than the Clave, and so would you if you were wise," he said. "He would have found the cup eventually, whether I helped him or not."
"And you don't care that he's going to use it to kill children?"
A spasm crossed his face. As he took a step forward, she saw something shine in his hand.
"Does all this really matter to you this much?"
"I told you before," she said. "I can't just walk away."
"That's too bad," he said,
and she saw him raise his arm and remembered suddenly Jace saying that Hodge's weapon had been the chakram, the flying disc. She ducked even before she saw the bright circle of metal spin singing toward her head. It passed, humming, inches from her face, and embedded itself in the metal fire escape on her left. She looked up. Hodge was gazing at her, the second metal disc held lightly in his right hand.
"You can still run," he said.
Instinctively, she raised her hands, though logic told her the chakram would just slice them to pieces.
"Hodge!"
Something hurtled in front of her. Something big, gray-black, and alive. She heard Hodge shout in horror. Stumbling backward, Clary saw the thing more clearly as it paced between her and Hodge. It was a wolf, 6 feet in length, with a jet-black coat shot through with a single stripe of gray. Hodge, the metal disc gripped in his hand, was white as a bone.
"You,"
he breathed, and with a sense of distant astonishment, Clary realized he was talking to the wolf.
"I thought that you had fled."
The wolf's lips drew back from its teeth, and she saw its lolling red tongue. There was hatred in its eyes as it looked at Hodge, a pure and human hatred.
"Did you come for me, or for the girl,
said Hodge. Sweat streamed from his temples, but his hand was steady. The wolf paced toward him, growling low in its throat.
There's still time, said Hodge. Valentine would take you back.
With a howl, the wolf sprang. Hodge cried out again, then there was a flash of silver, and a sickening noise as the chakram embedded itself in the wolf's side. The wolf reared back on its hind legs, and Clary saw the disc's edge jutting from the wolf's fur, blood streaming just as it struck Hodge. Hodge screamed once as he went down, the wolf's jaws clamping shut over his shoulder. Blood flew into the air like the spray of paint from a broken can, splattering the cement wall with red. The wolf lifted its head from the tutor's limp body and turned its gray, lupine gaze on Clary, teeth dripping scarlet. She didn't scream. There was no air in her lungs that she could have dragged up to make a sound. She scrambled to her feet and ran for the mouth of the alley and the familiar neon lights of the street, ran for the safety of the real world. She could hear the wolf growling behind her, feel its hot breath on the bare backs of her legs. She put on one last burst of speed, flinging herself toward the street. The wolf's jaws closed on her leg, jerking her backward. Just before her head struck the hard pavement, plunging her into blackness, she discovered that she did have enough air to scream after all. The sound of dripping water woke her. Slowly, Clary peeled her eyes open. There wasn't much to see. She lay on a wide cot that had been placed on the floor of a small, dingy-walled room. There was a rickety table propped against one wall. On it was a cheap-looking brass candle holder, sporting a fat red candle that cast the only light in the room. The ceiling was cracked and damp, wetness seeping down through the fissures in the stone. Clary felt a vague sense that something was missing from the room, but this concern was overwhelmed by the strong smell of wet dog. She sat up and immediately wished she hadn't. Hot pain drove through her head like a spike, followed by a racking wave of nausea. If there had been anything in her stomach, she would have thrown it up. A mirror hung over the cot, dangling from a nail driven between two stones. She glanced in it and was appalled. No wonder her face hurt. Long parallel scratches ran from the corner of her right eye down to the edge of her mouth. Her right cheek was crusted with blood, and blood was smeared on her neck and all down the front of her shirt and jacket. In a sudden panic, she grabbed for her pocket, then relaxed. The steely was still there. It was then that she realized what was odd about the room. One wall of it was bars, thick iron floor-to-ceiling bars. She was in a jail cell. Veins surging with adrenaline, Clary staggered to her feet. A wave of dizziness washed over her, and she caught at the table to steady herself. I will not faint, she told herself grimly. Then she heard the footsteps. Someone was coming down the hallway outside the cell. Clary backed up against the table. It was a man. He was carrying a lamp, its light brighter than the candle, which made her blink and turned him into a backlit shadow. She saw height, square shoulders, ragged hair. It was only when he pushed the door of the cell open and came inside that she realized who he was. He looked the same. Worn jeans, denim shirt, work boots, same uneven hair, same glasses pushed down to the bridge of his nose. The scars she'd noticed along the side of his throat last time she'd seen him were healing patches of shiny skin now. Luke. It was all too much for Clary. Exhaustion, lack of sleep and food, terror and blood loss caught up with her in a rushing wave. She felt her knees buckle as she slid toward the ground. In seconds, Luke was across the room. He moved so fast she didn't have time to hit the floor before he caught her, swinging her up the way he'd done when she was a little girl. He set her down on the cot and stepped back, eyes anxious.
Clary, he said, reaching for her, are you all right?
She flinched away, throwing up her hands to ward him off. Don't touch me. An expression of profound hurt crossed his face. Wearily, he drew a hand across his forehead.
I guess I deserve that.
Yeah, you do. The look on his face was troubled.
I don't expect you to trust me.
That's good, because I don't.
Clary.
He began to pace the length of the cell.
What I did, I don't expect you to understand. I know you feel that I abandoned you.
You did abandon me, she said. You told me never to call you again. You never cared about me. You never cared about my mother. You lied about everything.
Not, he said, about everything.
So your name really is Luke Garraway? His shoulders drooped perceptibly.
No,
he said, then glanced down. A dark red patch was spreading across the front of his blue denim shirt. Clary sat up straight. Is that blood? She demanded. She forgot for a moment to be furious.
Yes, said Luke, his hand against his side. The wound must have torn open when I lifted you.
What wound? Clary couldn't help asking. He said with deliberation.
Hodge's discs are still sharp, though his throwing arm is not what it once was. I think he may have nicked a rib.
Hodge? Clary said. When did you... He looked at her, not saying anything, and she remembered suddenly the wolf in the alley, all black except for that one gray streak down its side, and she remembered the disc hitting it, and she realized. You're a werewolf. He took his hand away from his shirt. His fingers were stained red.
Yep,
he said laconically. He moved to the wall and rapped sharply on it, once, twice, three times. Then he turned back to her.
I am.
You killed Hodge, she said, remembering.
No.
He shook his head.
I hurt him pretty badly, I think, but when I went back for the body, it was gone. He must have dragged himself away.
You tore at his shoulder, she said. I saw you.
Yes, though it's worth noting that he was trying to kill you at the time. Did he hurt anyone else?
Clary sank her teeth into her lip. She tasted blood, but it was old blood from where Hugo had attacked her. Jace, she said in a whisper. Hodge knocked him out and handed him over to Valentine.
To Valentine?
Luke said, looking astonished.
I knew Hodge had given Valentine the mortal cup, but I hadn't realized.
How did you know that? Clary began, before remembering. You heard me talking to Hodge in the alley, she said, before you jumped him.
I jumped him, as you put it, because he was about to slice your head off, Luke said,
then looked up as the cell door opened again and a tall man came in, followed by a tiny woman, so short she looked like a child. Both of them wore plain casual clothes, jeans and cotton shirts, and both had the same untidy flyaway hair, though the woman's was fair and the man's was a badgery gray and black. Both had the same young old faces, unlined but with tired eyes.
Clary, said Luke, meet my second and third, Gretel and Alaric.
Alaric inclined his massive head to her.
We have met.
Clary stared, alarmed. Have we?
At the Hotel du Mort, he said. You put your knife in my ribs.
She shrank against the wall. I'm sorry.
Don't be, he said. It was an excellent throw.
He slid a hand into his breast pocket and removed Jace's dagger with its winking red eye. He held it out to her.
I think this is yours.
Clary stared. But...
Don't worry, he assured her. I cleaned the blade.
Wordlessly, she took it. Luke was chuckling under his breath.
In retrospect, he said, perhaps the raid on the Du Mort was not as well planned as it might have been. I had set a group of my wolves to watch you and go after you if you seemed to be in any danger. When you went into the Du Mort...
Jace and I could have handled it. Clary slid the dagger into her belt. Gretel aimed a tolerant smile at her. Is that what you summoned us for, sir?
No, said Luke.
He touched his side.
My wounds opened up, and Clary here has some injuries of her own that could use a bit of tending. If you wouldn't mind getting the supplies.
Gretel inclined her head. I will return with the healing kit, she said, and left, Alaric trailing her like an outsized shadow. She called you sir, said Clary the moment the cell door closed behind them. And what do you mean by your second and third? Second and third what?
In command, said Luke slowly. I am the leader of this particular wolf pack. That's why Gretel called me sir. Believe me, it took a fair bit of work to break her of the habit of calling me master.
Did my mother know?
Know what?
That you're a werewolf.
Yes, she's known since it happened.
Neither of you, of course, thought to mention this to me.
I would have told you, said Luke, but your mother was adamant that you know nothing of shadow hunters or the shadow world. I couldn't explain away my being a werewolf as some kind of isolated incident, Clary. It's all part of the larger pattern that your mother didn't want you to see. I don't know what you've learned.
A lot, Clary said flatly. I know my mother was a shadow hunter. I know she was married to Valentine, and that she stole the mortal cup from him and went into hiding. I know that after she had me, she took me to Magnus Bane every 2 years to have my sight taken away. I know that when Valentine tried to get you to tell him where the cup was, in exchange for my mom's life, you told him she didn't matter to you. Luke stared at the wall.
I didn't know where the cup was, he said. She'd never told me.
You could have tried to bargain.
Valentine doesn't bargain. He never has. If the advantage isn't his, he won't even come to the table. He's entirely single-minded and totally without compassion. And though he may have loved your mother once, he wouldn't hesitate to kill her. No, I wasn't going to bargain with Valentine.
So you just decided to abandon her? Clary demanded furiously. You're the leader of a whole pack of werewolves, and you just decided she didn't even really need your help? You know, it was bad enough when I thought you were another shadow hunter, and you turned your back on her because of some stupid shadow hunter vow or something. But now I know you're just a slimy downworlder who didn't even care that all those years she treated you like a friend, like an equal, and this is how you paid her back.
Listen to you, Luke said quietly. You sound like a Lightwood.
She narrowed her eyes. Don't talk about Alec and Isabel like you know them.
I meant their parents, said Luke, whom I did know very well, in fact, when we were all shadow hunters together.
She felt her lips part in surprise. I know you were in the circle, but how did you keep them from finding out you were a werewolf? Didn't they know?
No, said Luke, because I wasn't born a werewolf. I was made one. And I can already see that if you're going to be persuaded to listen to anything I have to say, you're going to have to hear the whole story. It's a long tale, but I think we have the time for it.
Part 3. The Descent Beckons. The descent beckons as the ascent beckoned. William Carlos Williams, The Descent. Chapter 21, The Werewolf's Tale.
The truth is, I've known your mother since we were children. We grew up in Idris. It's a beautiful place, and I've always regretted that you've never seen it. You would love the glossy pines in winter, the dark earth and cold crystal rivers. There's a small network of towns and a single city, Alicante, where the Clave meets. They call it the Glass City, because its towers are shaped from the same demon-repelling substance as our steles. In the sunlight, they sparkle like glass. When Jocelyn and I were old enough, we were sent to Alicante to school. It was there that I met Valentine. He was older than I was by a year, by far the most popular boy in school. He was handsome, clever, rich, dedicated, an incredible warrior. I was nothing, neither rich nor brilliant, from an unremarkable country family, and I struggled in my studies. Jocelyn was a natural shadow hunter. I was not. I could not bear the lightest marks or learn the simplest techniques. I thought sometimes about running away, returning home in shame. Even becoming a mundane, I was that miserable. It was Valentine who saved me. He came to my room. I'd never even thought he knew my name. He offered to train me. He said he knew that I was struggling, but he saw in me the seeds of a great shadow hunter. And under his tutelage, I did improve. I passed my exams, bore my first marks, killed my first demon. I worshipped him. I thought the sun rose and set on Valentine Morgenstern. I wasn't the only misfit he'd rescued, of course. There were others. Hodge Starkweather, who got along better with books than he did with people. Maris Trueblood, whose brother had married a mundane. Robert Lightwood, who was terrified of the marks. Valentine brought them all under his wing. I thought it was kindness then. Now, I am not so sure.
Now I think he was building himself a cult. Valentine was obsessed with the idea that in every generation there were fewer and fewer shadow hunters, that we were a dying breed. He was sure that if only the Clave would more freely use Raziel's cup, more shadow hunters could be made. To the teachers, this idea was sacrilege. It is not for just anyone to choose who can and cannot become a shadow hunter. Flippantly, Valentine would ask, why not make all men shadow hunters then? Why not gift them all with the ability to see the shadow world? Why keep that power selfishly to ourselves? When the teachers answered that most humans cannot survive the transition, Valentine claimed they were lying, trying to keep the power of the Nephilim limited to an elite few. That was his claim at the time. Now I think he probably felt the collateral damage was worth the end result. In any case, he convinced our little group of his rightness. We formed the circle, with our stated intent being to save the race of shadow hunters from extinction. Of course, being 17, we weren't quite sure how we would do it, but we were sure we'd eventually accomplish something significant. Then came the night that Valentine's father was killed in a routine raid on a werewolf encampment. When Valentine returned to school, after the funeral, he wore the red marks of mourning. He was different in other ways. His kindness was now interspersed with flashes of rage that bordered on cruelty. I put this new behavior down to grief and tried harder than ever to please him. I never answered his anger with anger of my own. I felt only the sixth sense that I had disappointed him. The only one that could calm his rages was your mother. She had always stood a little apart from our group, sometimes mockingly calling us Valentine's fan club. That changed when his father died. His pain awakened her sympathy. They fell in love. I loved him too. He was my closest friend, and I was happy to see Jocelyn with him. When we left school, they married and went to live on her family's estate. I also returned home, but the circle continued. It had started as a sort of school adventure, but it grew in scale and power, and Valentine grew with it. Its ideals had changed as well. The circle still clamored for the mortal cup, but since the death of his father, Valentine had become an outspoken proponent of war against all downworlders, not just those who broke the accords. This world was for humans, he argued. Not part demons. Demons could never be fully trusted. I was uncomfortable with the circle's new direction, but I stuck with it, partly because I still couldn't bear to let Valentine down, partly because Jocelyn had asked me to continue. She had some hope that I would be able to bring moderation to the circle, but that was impossible. There was no moderating Valentine, and Robert and Maris Lightwood, now married, were almost as bad. Only Michael Wayland was unsure, as I was, but despite our reluctance, we followed still. As a group, we hunted downworlders tirelessly, seeking those who had committed even the slightest infraction. Valentine never killed a creature who had not broken the accords, but he did other things. I saw him fasten silver coins to the eyelids of a werewolf child, blinding her in an attempt to get the girl to tell him where her brother was. I saw him. But you don't need to hear this. No, I'm sorry. What happened next was that Jocelyn became pregnant. The day she told me that, she also confessed that she had grown afraid of her husband. His behavior had turned weird, erratic. He would disappear into their cellars for nights at a time. Sometimes she would hear screams through the walls. I went to him. He laughed, dismissing her fears as the jitters of a woman carrying her first child. He invited me to hunt with him that night. We were still trying to clean out the nest of werewolves who had killed his father years before. We were Parabatai, a perfect hunting team of two, warriors who would die for each other. So when Valentine told me he would guard my back that night, I believed him. I didn't see the wolf until it was on me. I remember its teeth fastened in my shoulder. And nothing else of that night. When I awoke, I was lying in Valentine's house, my shoulder bandaged,
and Jocelyn was there.
Not all werewolf bites result in lycanthropy. I healed of the injury and passed the next weeks in a torment of waiting. Waiting for the full moon. The Clave would have locked me in an observation cell, had they known. But Valentine and Jocelyn kept silent. 3 weeks later, the moon rose full and bright, and I began to change. The first change is always the hardest. I remember a bewilderment of agony, a blackness, and waking up hours later in a meadow miles from the city. I was covered in blood, the torn body of some small woodland animal at my feet. I made my way back to the manor, and they met me at the door. Jocelyn fell on me, weeping, but Valentine pulled her away. I stood, bloody and shaking on my feet. I could scarcely think, and the taste of raw meat was still in my mouth. I don't know what I had expected, but I suppose I should have known. Valentine dragged me down the steps and into the woods with him. He told me that he ought to kill me himself, but seeing me then, he could not bring himself to do it. He gave me a Kinjal dagger that had once belonged to his father. He said I should do the honorable thing and end my own life. He kissed the dagger when he handed it to me, and went back inside the manor house and barred the door. I ran through the night, sometimes as a man, sometimes as a wolf, until I crossed the border. I burst into the midst of the werewolf encampment, brandishing my dagger, and demanded to meet in combat the lycanthrope who'd bitten me, and turned me into one of them. Laughing, they pointed me toward the clan leader. Hands and teeth still bloody from the hunt, he rose to face me. I had never been much for single combat. The crossbow was my weapon. I had excellent sight and aim, but I had never been very good at close range. It was Valentine who was skilled in fighting hand to hand. But I wanted only to die, and to take with me the creature who had ruined me. I suppose I thought if I could avenge myself and kill the wolves who had murdered his father, Valentine would mourn me. As we grappled, sometimes as men, sometimes as wolves, I saw that he was surprised by my fierceness. As the night faded into day, he began to tire, but my rage never abated. And as the sun began to set again, I sank my dagger into his neck and he died, soaking me with his blood. I expected the pack to set on me and tear me apart, but they knelt at my feet and bared their throats in submission. The wolves have a law. Whoever kills the clan leader takes his place. I had come to the place of the wolves, and instead of finding death and vengeance there, I found a new life. I left my old self behind and almost forgot what it was like to be a shadow hunter. But I did not forget Jocelyn. The thought of her was a constant companion. I feared for her in the company of Valentine, but knew that if I came near the manor house, the circle would hunt me down and kill me. In the end, she came to me. I was asleep in the camp when my second-in-command came to tell me that there was a young shadow hunter woman waiting to see me. I knew immediately who it must be. I could see the disapproval in his eyes as I raced to meet her. They all knew I had once been a shadow hunter, of course, but it was considered a shameful secret, never spoken of. Valentine would have laughed. She was waiting for me just outside the encampment. She was no longer pregnant and looked drawn and pale. She had had her child, she said, a boy, and had named him Jonathan Christopher. She cried when she saw me. She was angry that I had not let her know I was still alive. Valentine had told the circle I had taken my own life, but she had not believed it. She knew that I would never do such a thing. I felt her faith in me was unwarranted, but I was so relieved to see her again that I didn't contradict her. I asked how she had found me. She said that there were rumors in Alicante of a werewolf who had once been a shadow hunter. Valentine had heard the rumors too, and she had ridden to warn me. He came soon after, but I hid from him, as werewolves can, and he left without bloodshed. After that, I began to meet Jocelyn in secret. It was the year of the Accords, and all of Downworld was abuzz about them and Valentine's probable plans for disrupting them. I heard that he had argued passionately in the Clave against the Accords, but with no success. So the Circle made a new plan, steeped in secrecy. they allied themselves with demons, the greatest enemies of shadow hunters, in order to procure weapons that could be smuggled undetected into the Great Hall of the Angel, where the accords would be signed. And with the aid of a demon, Valentine stole the mortal cup. He left in its place a facsimile. It was months before the Clave realized the cup was missing, and by then it was too late. Jocelyn tried to learn what Valentine intended to do with the cup, but could not. She knew that the Circle planned to fall upon the unarmed Downworlders and murder them in the hall. After such wholesale slaughter, the Accords would fail. Despite the chaos, in a strange way, those were happy days. Jocelyn and I sent messages covertly to the fairies, the warlocks, and even to those age-old enemies of wolfkind, the vampires, warning them of Valentine's plans and bidding them prepare for battle. We worked together, werewolf and Nephilim. On the day of the Accords, I watched from a hidden place as Jocelyn and Valentine left the manor house. I remember how she bent to kiss the white blonde head of her son. I remember the way the sun shone on her hair. I remember her smile. They rode into Alicante by carriage. I followed, running on 4 feet, and my pack ran with me. The Great Hall of the Angel was crowded with all the assembled Clave and score upon score of Downworlders. When the Accords were presented for signing, Valentine rose to his feet, and the Circle rose with him, sweeping back their cloaks to lift their weapons. As the hall exploded into chaos, Jocelyn ran to the great double doors of the hall and flung them open. My pack were the first at the door. We burst into the hall, tearing the night with our howls, and were followed by fairy knights with weapons of glass and twisted thorns. After them came the night children with bared fangs and warlocks wielding flame and iron. As the panicked masses fled the hall, we fell upon the members of the Circle. Never had the Hall of the Angel seen such bloodshed. We tried not to harm those shadow hunters who were not of the Circle. Jocelyn marked them out one by one with a warlock spell. But many died, and I fear we were responsible for some. Certainly afterward, we were blamed for many. As for the Circle, there were far more of them than we'd imagined, and they clashed fiercely with the Downworlders. I fought through the crowd to Valentine. My only thought had been of him, that I might be the one to kill him, that I might have that honor. I found him at last by the great statue of the Angel, dispatching a fairy knight with a broad stroke of his blood-stained dagger. When he saw me, he smiled, fierce and feral. "A werewolf who fights with sword and dagger," he said, "is as unnatural as a dog who eats with a fork and knife." "You know the sword, you know the dagger," I said, "and you know who I am. If you must address me, use my name." "I do not know the names of half-men," said Valentine. "Once I had a friend, a man of honor, who would have died before he let his blood be polluted. Now a nameless monster with his face stands before me." He raised his blade. "I should have killed you while I had the chance," he cried, and lunged for me. I parried the blow, and we fought up and down the dais, while the battle raged around us, and one by one the members of the Circle fell. I saw the Lightwoods drop their weapons and flee. Hodge was already gone, having fled at the outset. And then I saw Jocelyn racing up the stairs toward me, her face a mask of fear. "Valentine, stop," she cried out. "This is Luke, your friend, almost your brother." With a snarl, Valentine seized her and dragged her in front of him, his dagger to her throat. I dropped my blade. I would not risk his harming her. He saw what was in my eyes. "You always wanted her," he hissed. "And now the two of you have plotted my betrayal together. You will regret what you have done all the rest of your lives." With that, he snatched the locket from Jocelyn's throat and hurled it at me. The silver cord burned me like a lash. I screamed and fell back, and in that moment he vanished into the melee, dragging her with him. I followed, burned and bleeding, but he was too fast, cutting a path through the thick of the crowd and over the dead. I staggered out into the moonlight. The hall was burning and the sky was lit with fire. I could see all down the green lawns of the capital to the dark river. and the road along the riverbank where people were fleeing into the night. I found Jocelyn by the banks of the river, at last. Valentine was gone, and she was terrified for Jonathan, desperate to get home. We found a horse, and she plunged away. Dropping into wolf form, I followed at her heels. Wolves are fast, but a rested horse is faster. I fell far behind, and she arrived at the manor house before I did. I knew, even as I neared the house, that something was terribly wrong. Here, too, the smell of fire hung heavy in the air, and there was something overlaying it, something thick and sweet, the stench of demonic witchcraft. I became a man again as I limped up the long drive, white in the moonlight, like a river of silver leading to ruins. For the manor house had been reduced to ashes, layer upon layer of sifting whiteness, strewn across the lawns by the night wind. Only the foundations, like burned bones, were still visible. Here a window, there a leaning chimney. But the substance of the house, the bricks and the mortar, the priceless books and ancient tapestries, handed down through generations of shadow hunters, were dust blowing across the face of the moon. Valentine had destroyed the house with demon fire. He must have. No fire of this world burns so hot, nor leaves so little behind. I made my way into the still smoldering ruins. I found Jocelyn kneeling on what had perhaps once been the front door steps. They were blackened by fire. And there were bones, charred to blackness, but recognizably human, with scraps of cloth here and there, and bits of jewelry the fire had not taken. Red and gold threads still clung to the bones of Jocelyn's mother, and the heat had melted her father's dagger to his skeletal hand. Among another pile of bones gleamed Valentine's silver amulet, with the insignia of the circle still burning white hot upon its face. And among the remains, scattered as if they were too fragile to hold together, were the bones of a child. "You will regret what you have done," Valentine had said. And as I knelt with Jocelyn on the burned paving stones, I knew that he was right. I did regret it, and have regretted it every day since. We rode back through the city that night, among the still burning fires and shrieking people, and then out into the darkness of the country. It was a week before Jocelyn spoke again. I took her out of Idris. We fled to Paris. We had no money, but she refused to go to the institute there and ask for help. She was done with shadow hunters, she told me. Done with the shadow world. I sat in the tiny, cheap hotel room we had rented and tried to reason with her, but it did no good. She was obstinate. At last, she told me why. She was carrying another child and had known it for weeks. She would make a new life for herself and her baby, and she wanted no whisper of clave or covenant ever to taint her future. She showed me the amulet she had taken from the pile of bones. In the flea market at Clignancourt, she sold it, and with that money purchased an airplane ticket. She wouldn't tell me where she was going. The farther away she could get from Idris, she said, the better. I knew that leaving her old life behind meant leaving me behind as well, and I argued with her, but to no avail. I knew that if not for the child she carried, she would have taken her own life, and since to lose her to the mundane world was better than to lose her to death, I at last reluctantly agreed to her plan. And so it was that I bid her goodbye at the airport. The last words Jocelyn spoke to me in that dreary departure hall chilled me to the bone. Valentine is not dead. After she was gone, I returned to my pack, but I found no peace there. Always there was a hollow aching inside me, and always I woke with her name unspoken on my lips. I was not the leader I had once been, I knew that much. I was just and fair, but remote. I could not find friends among the wolf people, nor a mate. I was, in the end, too much human, too much shadow hunter, to be at rest among the lycanthropes. I hunted, but the hunt brought no satisfaction. And when it came time for the accords to be signed at last, I went into the city to sign them. In the Hall of the Angel, scrubbed free of blood, the shadow hunters and the four branches of half-humans sat down again to sign the papers that would bring peace among us. I was astonished to see the Lightwoods, who seemed equally astonished that I wasn't dead. They themselves, they said, along with Hodge Starkweather and Michael Wayland, were the only members of the former Circle to have escaped death that night in the hall. Michael, racked with grief over the loss of his wife, had hidden himself away at his country estate with his young son. The Clave had punished the other three with exile. They were leaving for New York to run the Institute there. The Lightwoods, who had connections to the highest families in the Clave, got off with a far lighter sentence than Hodge. A curse had been laid on him. He would go with them, but if ever he were to leave the hallowed ground of the Institute, he would be instantly slain. He was devoting himself to his studies, they said, and would make a fine tutor for their children. When we had signed the accords, I rose from my chair and went from the hall down to the river where I had found Jocelyn on the night of the uprising. Watching the dark waters flow, I knew I could never find peace in my homeland. I had to be with her or nowhere at all. I determined to look for her. I left my pack, naming another in my stead. I think they were relieved to see me go. I traveled as the wolf without a pack travels, alone, at night, keeping to the byways and country roads. I went back to Paris, but found no clue there. Then I went to London. From London, I took a boat to Boston. I stayed a while in the cities, then in the white mountains of the frozen north. I traveled a good deal, but more and more I found myself thinking of New York and the exiled shadow hunters there. Jocelyn, in a way, was an exile too. At length, I arrived in New York with a single duffel bag and no idea where to look for your mother. It would have been easy enough for me to find a wolf pack and join it, but I resisted. As I had done in other cities, I sent out messages through Downworld, searching for any sign of Jocelyn. But there was nothing, no word at all, as if she had simply disappeared into the mundane world without a trace. I began to despair. In the end, I found her by chance. I was prowling the streets of Soho randomly. As I stood on the cobblestones of Broome Street, a painting hanging in a gallery window caught my eye. It was the study of a landscape I recognized immediately. The view from the windows of her family's manor house, the green lawn sweeping down to the line of trees that hid the road beyond. I recognized her style, her brushwork, everything. I banged on the door of the gallery, but it was closed and locked. I returned to the painting, and this time saw the signature. It was the first time I had seen her new name, Jocelyn Frey. By that evening, I had found her, living in a fifth-floor walk-up in that artist haven, the East Village. I walked up the grimy half-lit stairs with my heart in my throat and knocked on her door. It was opened by a little girl with dark red braids and inquisitive eyes. And then, behind her, I saw Jocelyn walking toward me, her hands stained with paint and her face just the same as it had been when we were children. The rest you know.
Chapter 22. Renwick's Ruin. For a long moment after Luke finished speaking, there was silence in the room. The only sound was the faint drip of water down the stone walls. Finally, he said,
"Say something, Clary."
"What do you want me to say?"
He sighed.
"Maybe that you understand."
Clary could hear her blood pounding in her ears. She felt as if her life had been built on a sheet of ice as thin as paper, and now the ice was beginning to crack, threatening to plunge her into the icy darkness below. Down into the dark water, she thought, where all her mother's secrets drifted in the currents, the forgotten remains of a shipwrecked life. She looked up at Luke. He seemed wavering, indistinct, as if she looked through a blurred glass.
"My father," she said. "That picture my mother always kept on the mantle."
"That wasn't your father," said Luke.
"Did he ever even exist?" Clary's voice rose. "Was there ever a John Clark, or did my mother make him up too?"
"John Clark existed, but he wasn't your father. He was the son of two of your mother's neighbors when you lived in the East Village. He died in a car crash, just like your mother told you, but she never knew him. She had his photo because the neighbors commissioned her to paint a portrait of him in his army uniform. She gave them the portrait but kept the photo, and pretended the man in it had been your father. I think she thought it was easier that way. After all, if she'd claimed he'd run off or disappeared, you'd have wanted to look for him. A dead man won't come.